On this week's 51%, we speak with Gabriella Timmis of the nonprofit Braver Angels about how to heal the political divide with family, friends, and even strangers.
You don't have to be an expert on politics, and you don't have to be an expert on depolarization to be part of this work. It's really for anyone who's committed to learning and hearing from the other side.
We also learn how to navigate awkward or rude interactions with etiquette expert Elaine Swan. I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. Election season is here, and political tensions are high. I don't think I need to tell you that American politics are highly polarized. Some sociologists argue that everyday Americans are not as divided as we think, that we actually agree on way more than we disagree. But the perception of a divided nation is at an all-time high. A new Gallup poll finds 80% of Americans believe the country is divided on its values. That perceived divide has swallowed up friendships and driven a wedge between family members. It's infected schools and libraries and local governments. Regardless of who wins on Election Day, and at the time of this taping, the presidential election is still a few days away, how can we heal the political divide and move forward? Is it even possible at this point? Well, our main guest today believes it is. Gabriella Timmis is a spokesperson for Braver Angels, a nonprofit working to heal the divide by teaching Americans how to have healthier and more respectful conversations. She's also the blue or Democratic leader of its New York City Alliance. Braver Angels has more than 100 alliances nationwide, led by balanced teams of blue and red leaders who facilitate workshops in everything from family interventions to community-wide debates. I spoke with Timmis to get a sense of how Braver Angels practices apply in the real world. The goal, she says, is not to change how people view the issues, but how they view each other.
Interestingly, the aspect of polarization that we're working to address is not ideological polarization, but something we call affective polarization. It sounds a little wonky, but really it's just this idea that, if you and I disagree, it's not enough just to disagree, like you are now a threat to me, you're my enemy, et cetera. It's that those types of behaviors that we're really trying to address in Braver Angels. So people can come into Braver Angels as partisan as they want. That's by all means, you can fall anywhere on the political spectrum. But we're really just trying to foster dialogue between the two sides and get the two sides to really listen to and understand one another.
So where does this work even start? You know, before you even try to enter these kinds of conversations, how should you be entering the room?
Yeah, that's a great question. So certainly you have to at least believe that, you know, there's something to be gained through talking to and learning from the other side. We do have workshops specifically on exactly what you're talking about. So we have a workshop called Depolarizing Within, which really is about, you know, our own beings and our own selves and how can we find the ways that we're polarized or we're contributing to polarization in our own lives. So that's definitely a big part of it. I mean, and certainly one thing that, I think it's just helpful to know is that you don't have to be an expert on politics and you don't have to be an expert on depolarization to be a part of this work. It's really for anyone who's committed to learning and hearing from the other side. I can speak for myself that, like, I by no means knew how to have these conversations perfectly when I first started working with Braver Angels. But in a way, just by like marinating yourself in the organization and being a part of it and showing up at events and talking to people and befriending people across the aisle, just through the process of being a part of this organization, you really do come to learn. And it's just it's always an evolving learning process. So by no means do people have to be an expert, but certainly to be able to see that, you know, we do need to be able to talk to and learn from one another.
Tell me a little bit more about the events themselves. You know, are these workshops where you're dealing largely with strangers coming together, or do different groups call you like, we're having trouble here, we can't agree, help us come to an answer here?
Yeah, great question. So we have, I always kind of joke, I'm like, Braver Angels is like a mutant octopus because we grow a new tentacle each day and we address so many different aspects of society. We're in faith communities, college campuses, media, et cetera. But really the core of our work, it started with what we call the Red-Blue Workshop. So the Red-Blue Workshop brings together an equal number of reds or conservatives, people who lean right, and blues or liberals, people who lean left, to talk to and learn from one another. So in many cases, those are strangers. Sometimes they're members of the same congregation. Sometimes they're parents at a school. Sometimes they're legislators. So sometimes they do know each other and sometimes they don't. But so the core of that is to hear from the other side, to learn about the stereotypes, to break down the stereotypes, to learn about what is it that the other side actually believes, et cetera. So that was kind of the first part of our work. And again, with the Red Blue Workshop, it's not about finding common ground even. It's just really about learning and trying to understand the other side. We do have a bunch of other workshops that have grown out from that, one of them being the Common Ground Workshop. So in that workshop, it's specifically about trying to find common ground. Sometimes we have common ground, sometimes we don't. Again, the core of the Red Blue Workshop is really about that relationship and building trust. And then the Common Ground Workshop takes it a step further where it's like, can we look at a specific issue? So for example, right now we're looking a lot at immigration. Can we look at an issue like this and bring an equal number of reds and an equal number of blues together to see if we can find common grounds on our values, our beliefs, our fears, our concerns, and our solutions? Another thing that we do are debates. Our debates are not regular debates. They're a little bit different. It's a parliamentary procedure, but it's basically a way to get at a really controversial issue and bring people to the table and let people really state their views freely, fully, without fear, but in a way that it doesn't derail the conversations. Things don't get off track or get too angry. So we have debates, we have workshops, we also have one-on-one conversations, but all of our work in Braver Angels is done at the volunteer level. So we're the largest grassroots organization doing this work. We have over 100 alliances throughout the country. I'm the blue co-chair of my alliance here in New York City. And so it really is through those volunteers that we're able to put on all these workshops and debates and programs.
So what does that work of finding common ground look like? You know, I'm specifically thinking of issues like abortion or LGBTQ plus issues where, like, you know, opposing sides are in direct conflict with one another. Like, how do you find a compromise in that, especially in some of these situations, you know, like we're talking about people's rights?
So I can speak to another issue, actually, because we did a lot of common ground or workshops around it, which was trustworthy elections. Mm-hmm. So right after the 2020 election, one of our co-founders, David Blankenhorn, was just kind of, you know, observing what was happening culturally and was saying, you know, there's a decline in trust in our elections, and people are really, you know, starting to lose faith in this important, you know, this institution. And what can we do to really bring people to the table and hear what those concerns are and how we can ensure trust in our elections? And so that was an issue that we actually did. We did 26 common ground workshops over the course of a couple of years, and we ended up finding over 700 points of agreement between the two sides. And so sometimes in those cases, people just were operating off different information and they hadn't heard certain things, or they were learning from each other. They were hearing stories from each other. So I remember in one case, someone talking about how they were really surprised to hear about how at some polling places, there are really long lines in order to vote. And so that was just something that they hadn't really heard about before. So that was, you know, that was news to them. And they thought that was really interesting. They had a lot of really important conversations about ID and use of ID when voting and what should they do around that. They found a lot of common ground on simple things, you know, like making election day a holiday so people don't have to take the day off work to vote. And so, yeah, so with that issue, you know, sometimes it was just about what the information they were exposed to. Sometimes it was hearing each other's stories. You know, I remember one legislator spoke about how there was some like wonkiness when they were counting the votes of the district that he was representing, and he lost by one vote, and he wasn't, you know, sure about the whole process that went into it just because they had to count and recount, et cetera. And so hearing stories like that, it's like, okay, this is a person who's sitting across from me who I trust and who's a really wonderful person. He's sharing his authentic story about, hey, I lost this election by one vote. And it was a whole process of counting and recounting, and I'm having a hard time trusting that that was done really well. So, you know, when you just hear each other's stories, I think it kind of changes your perception of the issues themselves.
I guess what I'm wondering is how you foster that trust to begin with and get to that point where you can look at someone across the room and think, this is just a fellow person. You know, I trust that they're not specifically coming after me with their ideas. Because, I mean, the issues in our country right now are not small things. I also think of restrictions on transgender individuals in states across the U.S. You know, for some people, the culture wars and that feeling of this person's ideas threaten my existence might feel very, very real. How do you start in that place and develop trust from there?
Yeah, no, it's such an important question. I mean, I think first and foremost, just getting in the same room with as each other and sitting at a table. I know it sounds so simple, but I really have seen that make such a big difference. I remember there was actually one workshop that I was just an observer in, and at the end of the workshop, we were kind of going around and saying, you know, what did we enjoy and what did we learn and all of that. And a woman, she identified as red, and she said, you know, I haven't sat in a room full of liberals, you know, in years, you know. And she was like, I couldn't believe that I was even going to do something like this. And she was just amazed about, like, first about their ability to come together, you know, just in the room itself, but also once they were able to sit across from each other and see each other eye to eye, what they were able to talk about and how deep that conversation could go. So, you know, oftentimes these conversations happen online, and when they really, I believe, should be happening in person, and when you can really see and feel one another. So that's one thing. But the way that our workshops are structured, one of our co-founders, Bill Doherty, is a marriage and family therapist. So he works with couples on the brink of divorce. So it's a very apt metaphor here, where, you know, he knows what it takes to get two people who have a really complicated relationship and maybe see things very differently. He knows professionally how to get those two people talking and hearing each other and able to trust each other. So again, going back to that Red Blue workshop, the core of our work, it is literally structured in a way that it builds trust throughout the workshop. So you don't start the workshop talking about the issues or asking each other questions. You actually start by talking about stereotypes on your side. So, for example, the blues will go to one side, the reds will go to another side, and they'll talk amongst themselves. What are the stereotypes of our side? So, you know, the blues might say, we're elitist, or we're baby killers, or something like that. The reds might say, you know, we're racist and we're homophobes and stuff like that. And so they identify what are the stereotypes that often get, you know, slung at our side. And then they take the extra step of what is the kernel of truth? Is there truth to the stereotype? Which is a really interesting step, because when the two sides come back and they present, you know, their kind of findings to each other, hearing the other side say, hey, this is a stereotype on my side, it's not true, but there is a kernel of truth, and let me talk to that, and maybe that's where this stereotype is coming from. That itself can, it just disarms people, because firstly, it gets the stereotypes out of the, you know, out of the way. Like, you've already addressed them, you've already talked about them, you've already talked about what's true about it and what's not true and all of that. And then you go from there. And then, you know, beyond that, we have something we call fishbowls, where we might start with the reds talking in a circle, and the blues will listen, and they'll talk about where they agree with their side, where they don't agree with their side, you know, what frustrations they have, et cetera. And so the blues are just sitting there listening and observing, and they're like, wow, you know, it's really interesting. It's often can be very vulnerable conversations. And then they'll switch, and then the blues will go in the middle, and they'll talk about, here's where I agree with my side, here's where I don't agree with my side, et cetera. And the reds will listen, and then they'll pair off, and they'll see, wow, like, what did you learn just by hearing, you know, each side actually being able to talk vulnerably about where they agree? Because I feel like so oftentimes we're on the defense about our side, that we're like, you know, no, it's all good and whatever. But when you're actually asked, like, where do you disagree? There's actually probably a lot for most people. So I think just the process of being able to hear each other and giving people the space to show up as they are, and like, and I know it sounds like pie in the sky, but like truly in their full humanity. One of our first core principles of Braver Angels is like speaking freely, fully, and without fear. It's anything goes. Like, say what you truly believe. Like, we want people to talk about what they truly believe. This is a space for everyone. And being able to listen to each other, I think that starts to build the trust.
This sounds like something that a lot of families could probably benefit from, to be honest.
So, yeah, we have a family and politics workshop, actually. And we talk about with families, like, it's a whole other, there's so much more involved in that as well. Because, you know, I can speak for myself again, like, there have been times where I could have a really interesting political conversation with a stranger, and I'm like, how am I able to talk to a stranger I totally disagree with? But I can't talk to this loved one of mine that I totally disagree with. You know, you often think, like, I know this person really well, I love this person to death, but like, why can't we talk about this issue? And in our family and politics workshop, it actually kind of addresses that, because I once learned this term, which I think kind of applies here, which is like the term of like listening musically in a conversation, where there's the content of the conversation, there are the words that are being expressed, but then there's always like an undercurrent to the conversation that you kind of have to hear for. And I think when families are talking about politics, that is often, there's more than one conversation happening. So for a good example is like, if I'm disagreeing with my brother about something political, and I always felt that my mom took my brother's side throughout our childhood. You know, growing up, my mom always took my brother's side. And I'm talking to my brother about this political issue, and suddenly my mom jumps in and she backs up my brother. And then it's suddenly, you know, it's no longer a political conversation. It's an emotional, familial one where it's like, you always took his side, you know, it's something else comes to it. So, you know, one of the biggest reasons that people come to our work is because they're trying to heal a rift with a family member or a loved one. So you're completely spot on. Families are a big part of this, and they're a great metaphor, and they're also a great space for learning, because we have a lot of families that are politically divided that have come to our work and have really gained from it.
I'm curious how this kind of plays out in the wild. You know, like, what do you do if someone is trying to antagonize you or pull you into a debate that you don't really want to have, you know? Because I think a lot of us can relate to maybe tense family holidays, or I have some friends that I love dearly, but they get really amped up on certain subjects. And I remember even just like sitting in a hair salon a few years ago and having like complete strangers in the hair salon, like baiting me or trying to pull me into a debate with them. You know, I've kind of learned over the years that sometimes just mentioning that I work in news or mentioning what I do for a living just kind of sets people off. So I guess, you know, how do you navigate those situations?
So this is specifically relates to family, but I think you can see anyone can approach this anytime out in the wild, which is there are these six roles that family members may play in political conversations. There's the gladiator, which initiates the battle against wrong-headed people. So it sounds like maybe your hairdresser is a bit of a gladiator where they're going after and trying to, you know, provoke a little bit. There's the defender, which counteracts when others go first, but often by misrepresenting their position. So, you know, maybe someone shares their position and then someone responds, you know, oh, so you want open borders to everyone, yeah? Like, you know, that's the person that kind of misrepresents the argument. There's the sniper who gets in digs. There's the peacekeeper who tries to prevent all political conversations, et cetera. There are plenty of these different roles. But anyways, it's just to say, it sounds like your hairdresser is a bit of a gladiator, so a bit of an aggressor in the conversation. So there are a couple of ways that you can go about that. I mean, it's completely fair game to say, hey, look, it sounds like you and I don't agree on this. So, you know, maybe it's best for us just to leave it there. That's completely fair game. You never have to have a political conversation. No one is required to have a political conversation. And it's better to not have a political conversation than to have a really explosive, toxic one. So that's a fair response to something like that. But I will say, whenever I'm kind of confronted in a situation where someone is seemingly quite polarized and you know, unfortunately for you, like people have such strong feelings about the media more than anything else, maybe, honestly. Like we see even in our workshops that like people disagree on all sorts of things, but reds and blues together feel extremely activated about the media and the media's role in polarization. And I came from a media background. I used to work at NBC News. And so I know, you know, when I would say that, people put a certain judgment on it, but it's like, you know, there are thousands of people that work in the media. You know, you are not single-handedly responsible for any given headline or anything like that. But anytime I'm confronted in a situation where someone's maybe a bit polarized against me or my side or something I represent, or I'm clearly triggering them in some way, I often just start to ask questions. Like I just, that's what I like to do. I like to, you know, if I see someone that I totally disagree with, I'm like, this is a really interesting opportunity to learn from someone. Even if I think their views are abhorrent, by the way, even if someone, you know, for example, if I sat down with someone and they were the world's biggest misogynist and they hate, you know, I talked to someone just the other day that was like, I don't think that women should be in the workforce. I'm like, tell me why. Like, I want to hear about that. What led to that belief, please? Like, how did you come to that conclusion? So questions, like genuine questions of curiosity to me, I often, you know, again, maybe selfishly, I use it to my benefit. Cause I'm like, okay, here's a person to try to understand, and it will help me better understand the world or this viewpoint in some way. But certainly if someone's kind of being an aggressor, by no means do you have to engage. It's, you know, again, going back to just that line of acknowledging, hey, it sounds like you and I just don't agree on this topic. And that's, you know, I'm good with that, but maybe we should just leave it there because, you know, it doesn't sound like we're going to really get anywhere. I think that's completely fair.
Well, Gabriella, thanks so much for taking the time. This conversation obviously is airing around or on election day. Do you have any advice for those dealing with stress or animosity this time of year?
Yeah, well, I'll say there's so many different starting points. So one, I will say, we've done some really wonderful programs with this somatic therapist, Luis Mojica, and he has helped people get back in their bodies and kind of find safety in their own being. Again, it sounds it sounds different from our work, and it is, but it's a way to control what you can, basically. And so, you know, look up Luis Mojica. It's the holistic navigation. He's a really wonderful teacher, and I've learned a lot from him. But as for the conversations and the things coming up, I will say the single tip that changed my approach to politics and political conversations more than anything is do not try to convince the other person. It sounds like such a simple tip. It actually completely changed my approach to political conversations, because consciously or subconsciously, I was always going into them to change someone's mind. And so when you're listening, not to change their mind, but to actually learn from them, you get a lot out of it. You ask much better questions. First of all, you don't ask leading questions or accusatory questions. You ask genuine, what we would call questions of curiosity. Your anxiety level goes down. I will say the other person can often feel it. I once had a professor say, and it stuck with me always, human beings can't keep secrets. Like, we might be able to keep the content of the secret, but it kind of seeps out of us. So if you go into a political conversation, you think you're going to be super sneaky about trying to change this person's mind, it is going to come out of you, and they are going to feel it in the process of the conversation. So if you truly abandon that as a goal, you can have such a better political conversation. And then, you know, for me, like, genuinely, one thing that's helped me is taking action where I can. And like, that's why Braver Angels has been such a helpful outlet for me. With, you know, I used to be a person that was super anxious about elections and politics and really wound up about it. But they say action is the antidote to anxiety. So when you're engaging in this work and you're a part of it and you're talking to people across the aisle and you're making friends and you're seeing like, oh, that person I totally disagree with, but they're not as scary as I thought I was. Like, you know, they're not who I'm being told that they are. It can really reduce your anxiety levels, I've found. So a shameless plug, but I do think engaging in our work does reduce anxiety to some degree.
Gabriella Timmis is the spokesperson and blue leader for Braver Angels Local Alliance in New York City. Braver Angels is a nonprofit working to bridge America's political divide and foster healthier dialogues between citizens. They've got more than 100 alliances across the country. You can learn more about their workshops and find an alliance near you at braverangels.org. Gabriella, thanks again.
Awesome.
Our next guest is Elaine Swan, a nationally recognized expert on etiquette. Politics isn't the only thing that gets people riled up, and Swan's School of Protocol teaches teens and adults how to excel socially in the workplace and their private lives. Her latest book, called Let Crazy Be Crazy, specifically focuses on how to confront rude people without being rude yourself or getting pulled into drama. Our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds, spoke with Swan to learn more.
Etiquette encompasses the fact that we should approach everything with what I refer to as three core values, which is respect, honesty, and consideration. And with those three core values, in terms of looking at how we show up in the world, it's important for people to realize that etiquette has more to do with putting people at ease as opposed to how you use your knife and fork at the table.
So to kind of dive into that world of etiquette, do you have a favorite area in etiquette? Because there's so many.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I think my favorite, you know what gives me so much joy, is to share with folks how to deal with difficult people and challenging situations in a very firm yet polite manner. I tell people that polite does not equal pushover. And so when you think about etiquette and manners and decorum, people feel as though they have to shrink and be very demure and not speak up for themselves. But no, be mindful. Speak up for yourself. Mm-hmm. And you can put rude people in their place in a very gentle manner. And so that's my favorite thing to do, is to really give folks that aha moment. I had a speaking engagement yesterday, and I was talking with during the question and answer session, one of the folks, what do you do if someone just says something to you really rude and, you know, it's hurtful? And my response was stop in that moment and say, wow, that was really hurtful. Call that person out and let them know, and then pause. Allow that awkward silence to take place and you remain in control in that moment, and then move past that and say, you know what, I don't want to talk about that, or that's not a question, or I don't appreciate that comment. Let's change the subject. So I love, 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 love being able to empower people with the tools that they need to deal with those awkward situations.
How does etiquette impact women, maybe both positively and maybe even slightly so negatively?
Yeah, I think sometimes etiquette can impact women in a negative manner based upon the thought process of perhaps someone from another gender, right? So sometimes in the business arena, folks don't realize that etiquette is gender free. So if you are a manager at an organization and you're taking out a business colleague or a potential client and you're female and you're taking out a male, he does not have to pay. You still, as women, we should still keep our power in that instance and make sure that we're paying for it. He doesn't need to pull our chair out for us. He doesn't need to open the door for us or anything like that. And so I think that's where that gets a little bit mixed up and folks don't quite realize that it's gender free. And so I want ladies to know that you should move just the way you would in any normal circumstance, regardless of the gender of the person that you're dealing with.
And as an etiquette and lifestyle expert, is there any gender stereotypes that can be reinforced for women who maybe practice etiquette? And if so, how can women overcome it?
I think women can overcome some of the gender stereotypes by speaking up for themselves and not being afraid to share exactly what they're feeling or what they want in that moment. Again, I mentioned that we feel like we should not say anything, that with etiquette, you should just kind of let people do what they want to do. That's a big no. I want women to know that you have the ability to stand up for yourself, speak up for yourself, request what you want, and again, put rude people in their place.
So going back to your etiquette expertise, we are in the thick of this crazy election cycle, this crazy political world. And I want your expertise on some etiquette advice that you would give someone on how to handle maybe interactions or conversations with someone of a different political party, a different opinion, maybe even election day when your candidate doesn't win. So how do you handle those situations?
Sure. Let's start off with a difference of opinion, especially prior to the election. I think it's important for people to allow one another to be heard. And if you have a family member or a friend or a colleague who expresses that they are in favor of one candidate or another, you can do one of two things. You can either just shift and change the subject and leave it alone, or you can say, really, tell me what you believe or why you choose this particular candidate. I'd really like to know. And this is more so for people that you have relationship with. I think it's important. Instead of us just kind of running away or cutting off a friendship or relationship or what have you, get perspective, get that person's perspective. So ask them why, and then listen. Your purpose is not to debate that individual, but really just to hear things from their perspective. And this will allow you to getting that information will allow you to know how to navigate future conversations with them, kind of what those hot button issues are for them as well. So I think that's one thing that we should do. I know that we have always said in certain endeavors or areas, we should not talk about politics. But I do think in those personal relationships, it is important for us to allow one another to share our thoughts and our feelings, and it'll allow us to get to know one another and be respectful, right? Once the election happens, whichever candidate wins, my recommendation after the election takes place is for individuals to remain civil with one another. We all have to use those same core values, respect, consideration, and we should be civil. If you have very, very strong opinions, share those opinions with like-minded individuals. Speak to the choir as opposed to the outside. Speak to the choir and let your steam off to your own choir.
So in your book, Let Crazy Be Crazy, you detail how people can interact properly with quote unquote crazy and rude people using yes. etiquette. So I'm curious as to what etiquette techniques in that book of yours would you say you see yourself using the most in those situations?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So one of the ones that I use often is I refer to one of the tips is to be a wise fool.
Mm.
Uh-huh. So there's a proverb that says, even a fool is thought wise if he keeps silent. And so what I mean by this is that we do not have to have something to say all of the time. Just because someone says something to you or does something that's out of hand, we don't always have to respond. Sometimes we should just remain silent, because a person argument can only happen between two people. And if sometimes people can just chatter on and you can just let them peter out. In addition to that, if you're silent and you give yourself just a moment to take a step back, it allows you to kind of assess the situation, look at things from a different vantage point, and then be able to approach it from a more wise perspective, whatever it is, the conversation, the conflict, whatever it is. So sometimes be a wise fool, stay silent, assess the situation, and then move forward from there.
I have to mention this because this is radio, and in your book, you detail that using a radio voice can get you what you want. I would love for you to explain that.
Oh, yes. All right. So let's say, for example, you are calling customer service, or you're dealing with a family member or what have you. Instead of going after the person and saying, you know what I need to do is and we have that high pitched octave where we're really excited at that moment. Instead, I say, just take a deep breath and use your radio voice. This is when you say, you know, that's not something I'd like to talk about. I feel offended by what you just said. Oh, it's a little bit different there, right?
Yes.
So yeah, using your radio voice, that's just changing the tone of your voice, bringing it down a few octaves and speaking more from your chest, if you will. So you can, and of course, in that instance, you can show, you know, compassion, concern, intent, seriousness, and you'll draw folks in that way.
Etiquette is a cultural guidepost for our society. So how do you see it changing, and how have you seen it change in the past?
Etiquette has changed over the years. I mean, I've been in this business for over 20 years now, and there were things that we were telling people to never, ever, ever do. For example, we used to say, do not bring your cell phone into the restaurant, leave it in the car. That's an absolute no now. And we're even shifting more so now. For example, as we got towards the middle of that, in terms of technology, we would say, don't use your cell phone at the table at all. Just keep it in your bag. Bring it in the restaurant for emergencies, but keep it in your bag or pocket or what have you. Now, the advice is, it's acceptable for you to use your cell phone at the dinner table. However, it must have something to do with the conversation at hand. So this does not mean that it's acceptable to sit and text someone else and have a long-winded conversation or scroll through Instagram or TikTok or what have you. But it is acceptable for you to take your cell phone out and say, you know what, I don't know where our friend is. Let me text her and see if she's on the way. Or, oh gosh, that's a great movie. Maybe we should go see it. Let me see what time is the next showing. But everyone is involved in whatever it is you're doing on your phone. They understand why you're on your phone. So you use it and then put it away. And the reason why is because I think it's important for us to recognize that the person face-to-face with us, they have top priority. So we have to nurture those relationships that are in person and not be so disconnected when we're with folks. So it's certainly evolved.
I'm wondering, what basic etiquette rules do you think everybody should know to help them put their best foot forward?
Oh, basic rules, everything our mother taught us when we were younger, or, you know, our guardians taught us. Those are still traditional etiquette behaviors that we should still follow. For example, the body language that we use. There's a UCLA survey that says that 82% of communication is nonverbal. And so our body language says a lot, and that has to do with how we carry ourselves and conduct ourselves, using good eye contact when we're talking to folks, making sure that we treat people with decency and respect. These are just core values that are just not going to go away.
And then finally, why is etiquette important, and why does it matter?
I think etiquette is important because at the core of human nature, people want to be respected. They really do. And then on the flip side of that, based upon the emails, the DMs, and things that I get from people, individuals want to be sure that they're not doing something to offend another individual. So I get questions all the time where people will say, hey, Elaine, how do I say this to my friend or family member without sounding like I'm being rude or how can I handle this without being rude? And so people really, at the core, they just want to get along in society. And I think that that's a good thing. And so I think, you know, when we think about, you know, etiquette in general and what that looks like in everyday society, I think it's important because it allows us to operate and live in a civilized society. And it helps us to elevate our presence and our interaction with other individuals.
That was etiquette expert Elaine Swan speaking with our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. Swan's book is Let Crazy Be Crazy, Then Politely Get What You Want, Get Your Point Across, and Gently Put People in Their Place. You can learn more about her work at elaineswan.com. You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.